in power leans to you, and the court is on the way.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Princeton, your host for Wednesday morning call and talk radio here on Kibu Community Radio, where the time is 26 minutes before 8 o'clock, and the number to call to join in the conversation this morning is 503-231-8187. This morning we're going to continue in what seems to be a long series of shows about food. Last week we talked about sustainable food systems and a lot about sustainable agriculture, and the week before we talked about that and also food distribution and sustainable grocery stores. And this week we're going to move a little bit closer to home and talk about saving Portland's largest community garden, which is on the Reed College campus. Talk about what's happening with the garden and what you can do to help save the garden. I have with me in the studio Laura Schaefer, who is a recent Reed, well, relatively recent Reed graduate and one of the managers of the Reed Community Garden. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
So let's first of all talk about what is the Reed Community Garden, where is it, and why is it so important?
The Reed Community Garden is on the Reed College campus, and it's administered by Portland Parks and Rec. And it's 30 years old, and there are about 264 gardeners right now. And we donate food to fish every year. And in 2005, there were 3,000 pounds of food donated to the local food charity. And it's been a great learning experience and a community builder for everyone involved.
Well, let's just describe it a little bit, because, I mean, if people are familiar with the campus of Reed, part of it has, you know, it's kind of grass and lawns and buildings and this kind of manicured, and then part of it is this incredible canyon through which flows Crystal Springs, and it's been being really very well restored by the Reed College campus into a very, like, a natural wildlife habitat. And then north of that is what was, well, there's a soccer field, and there used to be a hospital there. And I guess up until 1976 was just kind of this grassy field. But there's all these amazing garden plots, and it's really, how large is it? It seems like it's a pretty large garden.
I've heard people say 1.5 acres, and I've also seen it written that it's 1.9 acres. I can tell you there are 155 400-square-foot plots, so you can do the math.
Right. And how many square feet are there in an acre? So that's 640 square feet, and so we'll figure that out.
Yeah.
So somebody might be doing that math, and they'll call us up and tell us how big it really is. But it is a beautiful space, and from the garden you look west and you see the Tualatin Mountains, and you see, you know, like, just kind of incredible sky, a lot more sky than you see in Southeast Portland.
Yeah.
And close by, it's surrounded by a lot of trees and a lot of habitat. And I was at the garden when I met you on Saturday, and I saw a great blue heron flying overhead at one point, and you hear all kinds of birds, and I heard you talking about hearing hummingbirds while you were gardening. So it's also not just a great place for people, but also a great wildlife habitat.
Yeah, it sure is. We do have a hummingbird that frequents a particular tree. He's really noisy. I think he's claimed the whole garden for himself.
And he goes a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. The beautiful song of the hummingbird.
That's right. Yeah, I have him in my garden, too, and they're quite wonderful to have around.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of the garden, because I think it was one of the earliest gardens, community gardens in Portland.
Yeah, it was one of the original 11 when that was started in the mid-70s at the inception of the Portland Community Gardens program. So it has been around for 30 years. It started out with 80 plots, and at some point it increased to 155. And we had a lot of gardeners that have been there for probably, maybe from the beginning, but we've had a lot of gardeners that have been there for decades.
Yeah, because my old friend Early Day, who's another garden manager, she said she's been gardening there for 17 years. And she's one of the older gardeners, but the garden is now 30 years old, so that'd be a long time gardening for somebody who'd been there the whole time. But it seems like it's mainly community people. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, that's right. No, I mean, no one would probably drive from way out of town
to garden. Well, I don't know. It's like, you know, it's a nice place to go if you're if you live in Portland. But are there very many Reed College students involved in the garden?
Right now, I think we have about 5 students involved, and overall I think it was in 2005 we did a survey, And 28 of the plots were assigned to Reed-affiliated people, so students, faculty, staff, and alumni.
So I know that most of the community garden plots around the city are owned on land that's owned by the Portland Parks Department, which has its own set of problems. But basically, it's land that's dedicated for community gardens. So I think, I mean, I'm not sure about this. Somebody else might call and correct me on this, but it seems like the Reed College community garden is one of the few that is not land directly owned by the city.
Yeah, that's right. The land has been donated by the college since, you know, 1975, like you're saying. I'm sorry, 76. And, we've been there a while, but since then, some things have changed.
So let's talk about what's going on now. Because there was an article about the garden, actually, in the Oregonian last year, and it's an icon, I think, throughout Portland, but especially in that part of kind of getting out there, southeast Portland and the Reed area, the Eastmoreland, Westmoreland area. And it's one of those little havens. Actually, there's a couple other little farms and gardens, big gardens in that area. But it's one of those icons. And when there was an article about what we're just about to start talking about, it seemed like there's an awful lot of public and community concern for protecting the garden. So what does Reed have up their sleeve now?
Well, I mean, they just bought in 2003 the Eastmoreland Hospital property. It's near Southeast 28th and Steele, and that happened in 2003. And even before that, they were talking about building more dormitories for students to increase the percentage of the student body that lives on campus. And even before the acquisition of the property, they were talking about siting the dormitories, possibly in the current site of the gardens. And since the acquisition of the Eastmoreland property, they've had to rewrite their master plan for the city, which is something that fleshes out the possible buildings they might be doing the next 10 or 20 years. And they talk about how they would like to build dormitories in the garden still, with or without the Eastmoreland the Eastmoreland Hospital property.
So, let's talk a bit about that property, because there's like an awful lot of space there. The garden doesn't take up all the empty space or non-built on space in that corner between Steele and 28th. I mean, where the hospital was, I mean, what's going on there? Right now, that's just like kind of basically a vacant lot, isn't it?
They leveled it, and I understand actually a lot of the materials were recycled from it, and it's right now it's just planted with clover, and I've also been told that some of the concrete from it, or a lot of the concrete, was actually disposed of by burying it in that site.
It's not a place where you'd want to garden.
We definitely have some questions about gardening there. We would like to definitely do some soil tests, since all the community gardens are supposed to be organic.
So a question is, why does Reed want to build right where the garden is?
That may have to do with their aesthetic for the college. In part, they talk about having continuity on the campus, and they talk about having the buildings close enough together so that you don't have to walk through a big unlit space. And it's a safety issue, and I understand that because I was a student there too. But they have 110 acres of campus now, and they have a lot of open space to work with.
So why do you think they want the garden?
Why they want to keep it?
Why do they want to build on the garden specifically? You think it because a garden is such an important feature for so many people in the community. Why would Reed want to destroy something that has built this great link between the college and the community?
Well, I think the current administration sees the garden as sort of a non-entity. I think they look at it as a blank slate. I don't think they look at it and see a garden. I think they just see a blank spot on their map. And I don't think that they're really, at this point, they may or may not really understand what it means to the rest of us that garden there.
So I know people have been trying to communicate with them about that. So far, no good.
We've had some communication about it, and it's hard to tell if it's getting through or not. Let's see, we started out by the volunteer managers at the garden started out by writing a letter to Colin Diver asking that we be included in their master planning process, because we kept hearing about what was going on with this plan that they're coming up with, and we had no way to give our input or even tell them what we thought of it. So we rewrote him a letter, and in a few months we were asked to help out with the planning process. They had these things called charrettes, where it's sort of they ask neighbors and community members what their priorities are for things like a master plan, and we went and we made quite a bit of noise about the garden at that meeting, and we are mentioned in the master plan, and they say we would like to keep the gardens if possible. And we would like to relocate them on or off campus, but so far we couldn't. It doesn't say this in the master plan, but so far they haven't come up with any site for us.
So there's a certain like lip service to the importance of the gardens, but that's about it.
Yeah, and I'd like to believe that they believe that the gardens are important, but so far they're not walking the walk, as far as we can tell.
Well, as somebody who's been gardening in the same spot for 13 years now, I know what it means to build up your soil. And moving a garden is probably not a whole lot easier than moving a house. Maybe it's harder than moving a house. So why would you even, I mean, why would they even want to move the gardens? What, I mean, and what kind of problems does it cause for the gardeners if you have to move your gardens?
Well, moving the gardens, disturbing the soil like that is first of all going to encourage all the invasive species that may or may not be there in the weeds. I don't know if anyone who gardens knows, if you just pull up weeds and chop them into little pieces, it makes it much worse. Problems with moving the garden, the main problem that comes to mind is the irrigation system that's there. It would cost tens of thousands of dollars to replace, and we don't, the community garden program doesn't have that money. We don't know where that would come from. We could always get a whole bunch of bulldozers and try and move the soil, but again, I don't know how much that would cost.
And dig it and put it in bucket wheelbarrows and move it.
I'm sure the gardeners would be willing to help as much as possible, but as far as I know, we don't have any gardeners with backhoes.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about why the garden is so important. What is Reed missing in the picture? Maybe let's talk a little bit about you and like how the garden's influenced your life.
Oh, yeah. Well, when I first came to Reed in 1999, this is before I was a student, when I was thinking about coming to Reed, I stayed in a dorm on the north side of campus, which is adjacent to the gardens, and I saw these gardens, and I was like, oh, wow, you know, this college put this together for the community. I had the mistaken impression that it was a Reed project, and I thought, oh, this is just the kind of place I want to go to. You know, the academics are very traditional, but they have a really open mind about experiential learning, and they clearly value their relationship with the surrounding community, because these community gardens that I saw. But apparently I was a little naive, maybe.
Yeah. Well, did you garden while you were a student?
No, I didn't garden as a student, but in my last semester, I was everyone at Reed writes a senior thesis. And I was finishing up my thesis, and it was a dark and stormy night in my thesis office, and I kept thinking about those gardens, how I'd rather just be doing something simple, like digging in the dirt. And I signed up for one right away, and at that time, there was a long waiting list for a plot, and there usually has been. And by the time I graduated, I had a plot already, and I could hardly wait.
And so you've been gardening ever since?
Yeah, I have.
And now you're a garden manager?
Yeah, I think I've been a garden manager for about 2 years now.
What does that mean, that you're a garden manager?
It's a volunteer position, and there are 5 garden managers, because there are a whole lot of plots to keep track of. And we have a couple things, like once a year, everyone's supposed to clean up their plot before winter, and we have to run around and make sure in the spring that everyone's starting their plot, because the point of it is that people actually use their gardens. And then we help organize work parties. We help organize the Produce for People program, where we donate the food to a local charity. And then we just try to mediate any conflicts between gardeners and just generally we point people for gardeners.
Well, I'm talking with Laura Schaefer, who is, as she just described, a garden manager at the Reed Community Garden. And the Reed Community Garden, which has been a neighborhood icon for 30 years, is being threatened by the bulldozer as Reed College is planning on going ahead with expansion plans and putting a dormitory right on top of where this incredible soil is. So let's talk about some of the other issues, that maybe the academic garden link that Reed is perhaps missing out on. Why would the garden be good for the academic part of Reed?
Well, first of all, one of our managers that she just graduated from Reed about 2 years ago, she wrote her senior anthropology thesis on Reed, on the Reed Garden as well as the Clinton Community Garden. So, I mean, that's a pretty concrete example right there of how the garden can enhance the academics at Reed. Also, you know, Reed has a SEEDS program. It's basically their service learning program. And students have expressed interest in getting involved with the garden through service learning. But at least recently, it's been too politically difficult for the service learning department at Reed to get into the garden.
Because the garden's being threatened by the administration.
Yeah, there's been a lot of noise on campus about it.
And again, if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. I'm talking with Laura Schaefer about the Reed Community Garden. I guess we should just get to the meat right now, because there is something people can do to protect the garden. There's a hearing this morning. Let's talk a bit about that hearing and what you guys are going to be doing.
There is a public a land use committee hearing this morning at 9 a.m., and Reed has submitted their master plan for review to the city. And this land use committee is going to make recommendations about the master plan as to whether or not it should be approved and upon what conditions. And this morning, a lot of us gardeners are going to be at the hearing. We're going to be delivering some comments. And we asked people to show up and wear a green shirt to show their support for the garden.
And you're wearing a green shirt, I can see.
So yeah, that's right.
You're on your way down to the garden to the hearing. So this is where the city steps in and basically approves or disapproves Reed's land use planning, their plan for expansion?
Yeah, that's right. And there are a few requirements that we think the Reed Garden fits into. The committee is supposed to ask them to preserve elements that enhance the appearance of Portland to make it a better place to live and work, and also improve Portland's economic vitality by enhancing the city's attractiveness to its citizens and to its visitors. And we see that the garden is fitting into those both.
Well, the thing, I mean, about if your idea of an aesthetic, which I have a feeling the Reed aesthetic might be the south side of the campus, where it's all kind of nicely manicured and landscaped and there's lawns everywhere. The garden is a very different aesthetic. Personally, it's what appeals to me. But I'm wondering if there is some kind of tension between having that much more rustic, all kinds of wild things growing and the unexpected and the incredible variety. Every plot is very different. Some are more traditional vegetable plots. Some have an incredible burst of color of flowers. Do you think that maybe this offends the aesthetic, the more the kind of stricter aesthetic of the Reed administration?
Yeah, I would probably say so. I know, I mean, Reed is trying to compete with a lot of East Coast schools, and they've been trying to go for sort of the East Coast school look, like they've been there for a really long time, and sort of this, this old dusty academic look.
It's kind of funny, because I actually grew up back east. I grew up outside of Boston. When I first saw Reed, I thought, this is a strange kind of mix of the Harvard and Yale campuses, but there's something much more magical, because amidst those red brick buildings that look just like they could be on Harvard or Yale, there's like this Commons, which is this very rustic building, and then just behind all that old East Coast academic look is this wild canyon. So, you know, I think that that's been part of the charm for Reed, and also what's ironic is Reed has a rather idiosyncratic reputation. In fact, I did a search in Wikipedia online to read about Reed, and they talked about how it's like got quite almost a wild reputation. One of the things that they had was like things like drugs on campus, and it was kind of a I guess it's a, I know that they, it was a place where a lot of LSD was made in the 70s. So it's got a pretty, you know, radical, wild reputation. And also it's had a long time reputation for having good relationships with the community. Obviously the community garden came out of that. So do you think that this new administration is trying to change the reputation of Reed?
I think that they've been trying to clean it up for a long time. You know, the student, they've always attracted a kind of a wild student body, even though the academics are really structured and really traditional.
And very rigorous, too. I mean, it's a hard school.
Yeah, I mean, when I was there, it was just like, I don't really know where people find the time for
recreational drugs.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think they've been trying to clean up the image for a while. I think there was some kind of drug use survey when I was there, and there was a big controversy over that, and whether it was really true and what we can do to combat it. I think there was even something in the Oregonian that there was a big hoo-ha over. But Reed has always had that kind of a wild reputation, and Reed has a new president since I think he came in 2004 2005, and things seem to have been changing.
Well, actually, a little bit before that, because the whole, it was an issue, I think, that kind of was the foreshadowing was something with the garden, with the famous trolley car barns Selwood that were, I mean, which was a funny thing. It was this, I didn't know it was a big battle point until they were gone. And then one day, I mean, I heard that there was this big battle going on. I kept going, where are these car barns? And then one day I went down 13th Street and went, oh, that's where they were, as they were being torn down. But it was something where the neighborhood saw this as a historic landmark, and Reed owned the property and was going to preserve them and work with the developer to preserve at least the facade of the car barns. And instead, at the last minute, they changed their plans and just tore down everything except one wall, which is left, which looks very strange. And they're putting in housing, a big housing project there now. But that really tore the relationship between Reed and Selwood. And I guess now Reed is doing the same thing in tearing its relationship with the eastern part of the neighborhood.
Yeah, so it would seem. I mean, and it makes a lot of people speculate. It's like, oh, has Reed gotten enough donations? Is it endowment big enough now that no one else matters?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, if people want to join the conversation this morning, we're talking about the Reed Community Garden and how it is being threatened right now by bulldozers. But I want to talk more about the garden and why people should care about the garden. Why is the garden important to you?
Well, the garden was important to me initially. After finishing my thesis at Reed, it was amazing to sit down on the ground and dig a hole and drop a seed in it and, you know, get something from nothing, it seemed almost. And that was really amazing, just on a personal level. I never get over that, just seeing a plant grow out of the ground and like, oh my gosh, food grows on plants. And so for me, initially, that's what it was about. And I saw my neighbors there in the other plots. And as a student at Reed, like, I never saw children. And there are people teaching their children about science there and be like, this is a seed. Plants make seeds. And you know, seeds grow into other plants. And these kids were probably more fascinated even than I was. And it was amazing to see people start to teach their kids about these things so early in life. And also, there are a lot of older people at the garden. And again, as a student at Reed, I never saw older people really, except for some of the professors. And it was great to be exposed to such a diverse group of people. And at the same time, everyone has their own way of gardening. You can learn so much about different styles of gardening. There's no one right way to do it.
Another thing, I understand too, that there's a lot of different ethnic communities that garden at Reed.
I believe so. I know there's a local teacher who teaches a learning disabled class there, and he's brought them there for years, and he teaches them things like, you know, just how, simple things, how to measure, how to hammer a nail.
But, I mean, Merrily did mention to me that there's, like, a group of Mexicans that farm, there's Vietnamese that farm. I mean, there's people farming from all over the world, actually, in that garden.
Yeah, I believe we had some refugees from Africa, I believe a year ago, that they started gardening, and they're totally in their native culture. They're totally used to growing their own food. And plus, as refugees, they don't have a lot. They don't have a lot of resources, so growing their own food is really important to them. Just to have something to eat.
Well, the other thing that's amazing to me when I'm over there, because I'm familiar with a lot of community gardens around the city, but most of them don't have the kind of expansiveness and perhaps incredible sunlight and soil that the Reed Garden has. I'm not sure I've seen anything growing at the level that you see at the Reed Garden. And I wonder, why is it so important to have that kind of open space in the city? Because a lot of people think, well, the city's to build on, then you have open space out of the city. Why is it important to be able to grow our food inside the city and to do it at such a scale as can be done on a large community garden like the Reed one?
Well, as we've seen recently, I mean, property prices are increasing. Gas prices are increasing. It costs more and more to bring our food in from far away. And it costs more and more for everyone to have their own private garden in their backyard. And it's eventually, if not now, it'll be a very cost-efficient way to feed yourself and your family. And it's a lot healthier than stuff that's been sitting on the shelf for a week.
Well, I'm talking with Laura Schaefer, and we're talking about saving the Reed Community Garden over on the Reed campus, right near the corner of Southeast 28th and Steele. And if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's 8 o'clock here on KBOO Community Radio at 90.7 in the Portland metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, and 100.7 in the Mid-Willamette Valley. And I'd be interested in hearing from people who garden, and for those of you who also garden in community gardens. A lot of us, I've been gardening in my own garden for many, many, many years in my backyard garden, in many different houses that I've lived in, and I've actually never actually had a community garden plot, but there's a lot of friends who do, and I've been spending a bunch of time at the Reed Garden for the last year as I've been working on this documentary about community gardens, and there's something that I kind of yearn for in when I'm at community gardens, because it seems like when you have problems with your own plot and in a community garden, you can turn to the next gardener. Maybe there's somebody who's 30 years older than you who knows an awful lot, who can tell you like why your tomatoes aren't flowering, aren't fruiting, or why your carrots are really stubby. So let's talk a bit about the kind of things that you can learn. You were talking about the cross-generational beauty of the garden, but how can gardeners like share their experience in community gardens in ways that it's hard to do it when you have a solo plot?
Well, I definitely had that experience myself. There was an older gardener who'd been there for years and years who was kitty corner from my plot, and I was always asking her things. She was always really willing to help. Let's see, I started off with a plot, excuse me, that it had grass about up to my knees. It doesn't take long for that to happen when the soil's so good, and I didn't really know where to start. I started weeding. And I just was kind of pulling the tops off the plants, which I laugh at now. And the first thing she told me is they're going to come right back.
Got to pull from the roots.
Yeah, now I know. It had been a long time at that point since I'd really gotten my hands in the dirt. But, my name was Betty, and she was always there to tell me what would grow there. I'm originally from Columbus, Ohio, and so I couldn't believe the kinds of things that would grow in Portland. Like, you can grow broccoli here? It's way too hot in Ohio.
So, actually, we've got some callers, and then we'll start talking more about what grows in that garden, because that's pretty amazing, too. If you want to join the conversation this morning, we're talking about the Reed Community Garden and how to save this Portland's largest community garden. I'm here with Laura Schaefer, who's a garden volunteer manager and also a recent Reed graduate, and you can join the conversation by calling 503-231-8187. And I also want to mention that this morning at 9 o'clock at the Portland Planning Department, which is at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue, Suite 3000, there's going to be a hearing that the city's doing on the Reed Master Plan, and will it or will it not contain the garden. And people who are garden supporters are showing up at this hearing. They're wearing green to support the garden, and they're going to be addressing why it's very important for the vitality of and the economic security and the cultural and every other kind of security of Portland to really protect and preserve this garden, and why community gardens are a very important part of the city. So you can, again, go to this hearing this morning at 9 a.m. at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue, Suite 3000. And if you want to talk about the garden or your own gardening or your own experience in a community garden around Portland or anywhere around the world, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 4 minutes after 8 o'clock here on KBOO. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I actually am a community gardener. I have a plot at the Fulton Community Gardens in southwest Portland, and I think that having the community gardens is a great asset to the city on many different levels. And earlier, is it Lori?
Yes, Laura.
Earlier, Laura was saying, you know, just sustainability-wise, how it's good for people to have a community garden and be able to grow their own food. And but she also mentioned, you know, her first experience of just connecting with the earth and growing something from seed. And I think that as the city expands and you build more and more, you know, homes and properties are escalating, that it is important to have a space for people to connect with the earth. And although Portland is very vast and we're able to connect with, you know, the ocean and the mountains and the rivers and so on, it's difficult for people who live in the city who don't have transport to get out of the city to be able to have a space to connect. I think that in general, you know, one of the things that's going on in our world overall is that people, you know, have lost their connection with the earth. And I think to have a space where people can, you know, have a community of people to share knowledge with and experience with and just to have their own space to connect with the earth is extremely important, as well as growing food and providing for their families.
Well, are you by any chance able to go down to this hearing this morning?
I know. Actually, I'm a medical student and I have an exam. so I won't be able to attend, but I think that message, you know, if Laura can bring that message forth, I think that it's very, very important because you know, the sustainability of the world is at stake, you know, in a global sense. And, you know, Portland is a very green city, but I think that it's because of the community of people that, you know, that fight for this type of thing. And, you know, I'm from the East Coast, I'm from New York, and we definitely do not have any type of community gatherings like this in support of gardening areas or anything of the sort. And I think that, you know, with the new president and Reed, you know, bringing in this new image and such, I can understand that on one sense, but also, you know, they need to realize what they have with the community and really support that and look at a bigger, more global sense of what the uniqueness of Portland is and what really brings people to Portland and to Reed College and just, you know, hopefully continue to support that and understand what they really have.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for calling.
Thanks.
And the number to call is 503-231-8187. We're talking today about saving the Reed Community Garden, which is the largest community garden and one of Portland's oldest. And I have with me Laura Schaefer, who is a garden manager there. And if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 7 minutes after 8 o'clock. Hello, you're on the air.
Is that me?
It's you.
Oh, thanks. This is David Burton. I was a student at Reed in the 60s and worked on the grounds crew to keep myself from going nuts with all thesis work. And that actually ended up becoming a gardener later, so it's kind of an interesting circle. You might try reminding the administration that they have a long connection to the community, you know, from the beginning with the canyon and the Italian Valley family that was gardening at the edge of 28 there.
Now, what happened to that garden? I've been noticing that's been fallow for the last couple of years.
I haven't spent any time over in that area, so I don't know. I would assume that Harry Rivelli died and the family stopped working there. But he used to grow watercress in the canyon water, and he had a recycling operation there with people dropping off their leaves, and he'd sell it back to those of us that came to pick it up. But when I was a student, Ed Schultz was the groundskeeper, and we used to go in there and prepare the ground for people. You know, there was no discontinuous relationship. It was all very amiable. So I'm not sure when things got disconnected. You might just try reminding them that there's a long history there. And
well, another thing that I think that they need to be reminded of is that they're doing this great job of restoring the canyon. And, I mean, the canyon had At one time, they dammed up the Crystal Springs, and it was basically a swimming pool.
Yeah, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they totally blocked Salmon Passage, and they were, I mean, what was growing along the banks of the canyon was not very good for wildlife habitat, and they basically went in the last 4 years and cleared out all the invasive species, the English ivy and everything that was growing up and down the canyon, and they've been replanting cedars and all and everything at the proper riparian habitat, and I think they're bringing salmon back in there. They got rid of the, they changed the, well, they actually got rid of the dam, I guess, or didn't get rid of it. They got rid of it, have, like, opened up Fish Passage. There's now bridges across the creek where there used to be basically this big...
It's a big blockage.
Big block, yeah, big block in the artery.
Yeah.
And so it's really lovely in there. And, in fact, I have a friend, I have a couple of friends who like to walk their dogs up there. And I've been up there a bunch in the, like, 90s, and I think the last time I'd walked there was in 2002, and then I went up just a few months ago and was like, wow, this is a totally different place. So Reed is doing a lot on their part as being part of the Johnson Creek watershed to restore their little corner of the Johnson Creek watershed, which is a big watershed-wide project. And why they can't make the connection between why it's important to preserve and protect the habitat along Crystal Springs and to preserve this other habitat for people and wildlife that's just north of Crystal Springs in the garden. I mean, I think that's a connection that really has to be made for them, so they appreciate that the garden, preserving the garden is every bit as important and very much connected to preserving the watershed in the campus.
That's right. Yeah, that'd be great. Anyway, I didn't hear the first part of the conversation, but you were saying something about needing help with irrigation or tractors or something.
Well, that's if they have to move. I mean, if the garden has to move, then they're going to have to, like, recreate the irrigation system, basically.
Yeah.
And the other question is, if they have to move the garden, how do they get all the soil that they've been building up for 30 years to the new location, which is basically going to be, I was watching people pulling out Johnson grass when I was there Saturday. In fact, that's why I met Laura. She was pulling Johnson grass out. And I would imagine that there'd be, like, really bad instances of all kinds of noxious weeds that would have to be pulled out of a new garden space, and it'd be great to be able to take this wonderfully nurtured soil and put it onto site.
Well, if it gets to that, they can call me for help.
Okay. Well, do you want to leave your number at the with my engineer, and we can? I'm sure that Laura would be interested in being able to get in touch with you later.
That'd be great.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling. And if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 12 minutes after 8 o'clock here on KBOO Community Radio. And I'm talking this morning with Laura Schaefer, who's one of the managers of the Reed Community Garden. And the Reed Community Garden, which is Portland's largest community garden and one of its oldest, is being threatened by the very college that has been donating the land and inviting the community on for 30 years. And now that college is talking about putting a dormitory right where this garden is. And so today, if you want to help support this garden, you can go down to the Portland Planning Office at 1900 Southwest 9th Avenue at 9 a.m., Suite 3000, to show up for a hearing to support the garden and speak out for why community gardens are important for all of us here in Portland. And we talk about the livability of our city, and one of the cornerstones of our city's livability is all these urban gardens that are everywhere, particularly the community gardens, which are in many neighborhoods, not all of them, but many neighborhoods throughout Portland. And the Reed Garden is kind of like the great-grandmother of them all. And to destroy the Reed Garden, besides destroying 155 plots and 200 and some odd gardeners who are dependent on these garden plots, it also is a symbolic blow, I think, to what we value here in Portland and the connection that we feel to the food that we like to be able to eat. I mean, I think that's an important value in Portland, is that a lot of people in Portland grow their own food at least part of the year. And people in the Reed Garden, some of them grow it year-round.
Yeah, you bet.
So if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello. My name is Nancy Comstock, and I was drawn. I'm actually a gardener at Reed.
Your name sounds familiar.
Yes, I met you, I think, last summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been just so impressed with being a gardener there. And it's such a sacred place for me to go during the day. I see all kinds of wonderful wildlife, hummingbirds. I see hawks, and just yesterday I saw a male duck wandering through the garden. And I was drawn to the garden. I'm a landscape painter, and last summer I was just jaunting about looking for spots to paint, and I was drawn up to the garden and immediately got a plot. And so I've just been thrilled to go up there. It's a great getaway for me. And also to be involved with all the gardeners and learn all the different, you know, skills that people have put their hard work into, you know, just cultivating their gardens. So, it's sad for me to see it go, if indeed that's what's going to happen. So I'm actually going to be down meeting this morning. So I just heard this, heard the radio show, and thought I'd call in for support.
Great. So you are going to be going down to the hearing?
Yes.
Great. So what are you going to be saying when you go down there?
Well, basically, I'm just going to, basically what I'm saying here this morning, that for me it's a sacred place, the garden is.
Yeah, I was talking with one of the longtime gardeners there. I think his name is Axel.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was talking with him on Saturday, and he was talking about it being a sacred place. And in fact, there was an architect who is working with Reed on their master plan, and the architect referred to the garden as a sacred place. So, I mean, it's like a lot of people get that.
Yeah.
Except for this guy who's the president.
Well, you practically have to go there and seat yourself in the middle of it and experience it. And really see how wonderful and how colorful and what it, just what it does for your heart. It's a wonderful spot.
Well, you know, there's something that's interesting to me, because a lot of agricultural land, it doesn't feel like sacred land. I had friends who lived outside of Independence. I used to go down and visit them a lot, kind of in the heart of commercial farming in the Willamette Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going through and you're smelling pesticides, and there's just these kind of boring rows of monocrops and a lot of practices that are very destructive to the landscape, and they've turned creeks into irrigation ditches. And it's not sacred space, and you don't feel even that much connection to nature in those kinds of farms.
Mm-hmm.
But the kind of gardening, and in fact some farming that's going on in the Reed Garden, is a totally different thing. There's a reason why there's so much wildlife there. And it feels like it's a real integration of nature into a process of providing food and beauty, because there's incredible, beautiful flowers there as well. And then there's this sort of this unexpectedness. You go from plot to plot, and it's exactly the opposite of monoculture, large, you know, multi-acre fields. So I think that that's also a value that where, you know, you're talking about all the wildlife and why it's sacred. I think that's why a place like the Reed Garden feels sacred, whereas I guess a monocrop of wheat just doesn't feel sacred.
Yeah. Well, and it's also such a large garden that you can meander through, and it's just a wonderful experience. It truly is.
Yeah, I've actually meandered through it a few times with my bicycle, like walking my bicycle through it to get from one end to the other. It's kind of neat. I mean, I've actually found the good bicycle paths through the garden. It's a lot of places you don't want to even walk your bike through, but it's also this sort of a nice feeling when you're there and you suddenly, like, you bicycle over there and then you get off and you're kind of walking through this really magical place, and it sort of connects to this whole other world. I think that, you know, the way I feel like when I'm biking, where I feel like I'm kind of in a magical place, and then I get off at this garden and I'm in this Eden, and it all, you know, I feel like I'm very far away from the kind of culture where you're stuck in your car and you're stuck in the store and you're stuck on asphalt.
It's absolutely true. And then it's just backed by that whole green space and the canyon with the creek. And so I believe there's 165 plots that are 20 by 20 foot. And so it's expansive. It's large, and it's exquisite, truly.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
And good luck with the struggle.
Okay.
And we're talking this morning about preserving and protecting and saving Portland's largest community garden, the Reed Community Garden. And I'm joined by Laura Schaefer, who is one of the garden managers and a graduate of Reed. And Laura, you were telling me on Saturday ways in which working in this garden have actually shaped maybe your future.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've just quit my job because I'm going back to school for landscape architecture. I'm going to be getting a master's in landscape architecture at University of Massachusetts. I wish I could have stayed in Portland. But but in the garden, I saw what a huge impact green space can make on community and people's individual lives. and how it can have a direct positive impact on the environment. And I wanted to build more. So it seemed the best way to do that was to become a landscape architect and help to plan these sorts of things.
And we hope you come back to Portland and do some planning. I mean, that's another thing that's a really important issue, I think, is like talking. And I know I've had Leslie Paul Kasbaugh on the show, who also gardens at the Fulton Community Garden, is the garden where one of the previous callers gardens at. And she's talked about the importance of seeing gardens as part of the fabric of planning the city. And a lot of people who are real involved in the community garden movement talk about the fact that the value of land, open space, is just as important both commercially and every other way, psychically and spiritually and environmentally, as built space. And that we need to really start seeing our cities as a combination of built space and open space, and that having places where that are so fertile that you can actually grow food in the city should be valued, you know, as part of the capital, whatever they call that, the natural capital of the city, that this should be as important as looking at the development potential of a lot and seeing high rises and taxes and all that. And is that something that's being talked about, as you know, with the college and in the presentation to the city today?
It is to some degree. I believe in the master plan that the committee is going to be looking for Reed to fulfill some requirements about open scenic space in Portland. And we felt that the garden fit right into that. It's it requires that that Reed preserve its scenic resources, because it's considered a scenic resource zone by the city. And we thought the garden fit right into that. And plus, I mean, as long as we're talking about gardening in the city, I mean, the garden does the same thing that planting trees does. It helps clear the air.
And actually, it does. I mean, it's much more, well, I'm not sure, it's more complicated than trees, but there's a whole lot of other stuff that goes on the ground. I mean, when we see trees are kind of the iconic plant species, and you see trees and you think, oh, we've got, you know, great natural space, but trees need all these other plants to do all kinds of things, including fixing nitrogen. And the stuff that goes on in a garden, it makes me think of like an ant colony. They're all so busy. All these plants are so busy doing all these wonderful things for the soil. And then, of course, they're also feeding us. And the other part about, I'm assuming, with the Reed Garden, since it's an organic garden, that people use a lot of the plant waste material that goes back into the soil. So the whole garden is kind of feeding itself.
Yeah, it does. People do compost all of their plant waste if they can, unless they want to haul it home in their car.
and use it to compost their own yard or something.
Yeah, well, I've been known to do that off and on, but mostly I try to compost it there. It is. I mean, it plays into the diversity of the whole place. The gardeners, the population of gardeners are diverse. The plants that we all grow are diverse. And it supports some diverse wildlife. And if you walk through, people have... the first year I gardened, I read as a elementary school student that the Indians grew corn and beans together, because corn requires a lot of nitrogen and is a huge drain on the soil, while beans fix nitrogen in the soil. Actually, that's what my senior thesis at Reed was about, was nitrogen fixation. So they feed off one another, and they sort of create their own little cycle that balances out.
Yeah, we were having a discussion Saturday about growing lupin and problems with growing lupin, which is one of the problems I've been having in my garden at home, is that I had these beautiful lupin, and the last couple of years they just about arch to flower, and then they just die. And so I finally had to pull them all out. But I was talking with people at the garden Saturday about, well, lupin is like a really good thing to grow in your garden, because it's a legume, and legumes are the only plants that fix nitrogen. So when you grow legumes, there's a couple others that might also do it, but the great thing about growing beans or peas or lupin is that when they don't drain from the soil, they actually put back nitrogen into the soil, and they have a way of taking the nitrogen from the air and putting it into the soil magically. It's all this magic of gardening. And so you want to have this kind of diverse array of plants that are all kind of helping each other out.
Yeah, that's right. And lupin, I mean, legumes all require a symbiotic bacteria to colonize their roots to fix nitrogen. Maybe you were lacking that in your soil.
I should have you come out and look at my...
I would love to.
Okay, before you go to Massachusetts.
I would love to. But, yeah, I mean, you'll see in the garden during the winter, people will plant a red clover cover crop. and clover also fixes nitrogen in the soil. People do that on purpose because it enhances the soil.
The clover I've got.
Yeah.
Okay, well, if you want to join the conversation, we're talking today about saving the Reed Community Garden. And you can do that in many ways. One way is to go to this hearing that's coming up this morning at 9 o'clock at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue, Suite 3000. The city's hearing reviewing Reed's master plan, and it's time for community input about why Reed should include this incredible garden in its future planning and, you know, think about preserving this garden for perpetuity, as we say. And I'm joined by Laura Schaefer, who is a manager at the garden, and also she's going to be a professional gardener when she grows up. So you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 24 and a half minutes after 8 o'clock here on KBOO Locus Focus. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yes, talking about lupin, there was an open field to the east of the community garden that Reed has since plowed up and put into grass, and there was native lupin in that field. And it was very large lupin. In fact, I tried to dig one up. I did. But it's incredibly hard because the roots are incredibly deep, and the lupin, such as I dug up, didn't take hold on our property. But that's interesting that that did happen over there. And the other thing, Reed's relationship with Portland. And the Portland required Reed to spend probably a couple of $100,000 to build sidewalks along Woodstock and then on Reedway because they just required it to do it. I don't think Reed wanted to do it, and there are sidewalks on the other side of the street. In fact, there's some people on Reedway even now, the private owners, that don't have sidewalks, but they're not made to have a sidewalk. So I don't know. You know, the obligations go back and forth. But anyway, I think that's what happened. The city required Reed, probably because they were doing some construction. Well, you got to put these sidewalks in.
Actually, when Reed put the sidewalks in on 28th, which they did, first they put them in on Woodstock, and then they put them on 28th. And they had this wonderful kind of native habitat that just grew right down to the roadway. And they took it all up, and they put bark dust in between the beautiful cedar trees that are still there and kind of ruined the understory when they put that sidewalk in. And I was rather disturbed. I didn't know what was going on. I noticed as I've been going by there lately that the understory has returned. I guess the bark dust was not as destructive a mulch as I feared it was going to be. And now there's a lot of native plants that are growing amongst the trees again. But I do think it's interesting that the city would impose sidewalks on Reed as being a very important part of being a good neighbor, because I think having sidewalks does help people to walk. And
they could walk on the other side of the street. There is no need to put the sidewalk for a couple of $100,000.
Well,
I don't think so.
But I think that Reed owes it to the community.
Fine.
Even
well,
more.
What
I'm going to say is that Reed owes it to the community more to protect this community garden. That I think that putting sidewalks in maybe helps, you know, in being a neighborly fashion, but protecting the garden, I think, would be actually a much bigger gesture towards really serving the community.
Well, can you tell me why there are no community gardens in the Pearl District, or are there, or down in south, you know, in the waterfront south of the Ross Island Bridge? If it's such a good idea, why is all the property going to be put into development?
Well,
unless they have greenways, and there's not going to be any community gardens on the greenways.
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think that that's something that should be brought up, and that the community garden should be part of the planning of all the new neighborhoods that are going into Portland.
Well, anyway, I think dream on somehow. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your negative call. Anyway, the number to call is 503-231-8187. It's about 28 minutes after 8 o'clock. And, Laura, you need to take off pretty soon, right? So
yeah,
do you have any last words before we let you go to the hearing that you're going to be going to?
Well, and somewhat in response to that call, I'd like to just say that we're hoping that that Reed's commitment to the garden that they've had for 30 years is really where their commitment is going to continue to come from. We're not... We really don't want the city to come and whack Reed about the head about the gardens. We're hoping that Reed will just, you know, out of the goodness of its heart, which we know is there because it has been for 30 years, that they'll continue the garden and just recognize the value that they've contributed to the community for 30 years now.
Okay, well, Laura Schaefer, wanted to thank you for joining us. Good luck with the hearing today, and we'll keep in touch about what's going on, and also good luck with your future endeavors in studying to be a landscape architect.
Thanks very much.
Enjoy the rocks in Massachusetts.
Oh, boy.
Okay. So we got some more callers, and Laura can leave. Okay, just take those headphones off and slip out of here. Okay, so if you want to join the conversation, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 29 minutes after 8 o'clock, and we're talking today about saving the Reed Community Garden. And I also want to talk a little bit about this big urban farm in L.A., which is also about to be bulldozed, and there was a kind of a nationally covered series of protests to try to save that urban garden. And I was just reading last night that the last protesters were pulled out of trees and that they will be bulldozing that for housing development in South Central Los Angeles. So we kind of can tie that in. Anyway, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Good morning.
I've been down to the community garden at Reed, and I think it's a beautiful place. But I kind of have conflicting issues with the whole thing. There's a couple things I was hoping to ask Laura, but I guess she's gone.
Yeah, she's got to go to that hearing. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's how it goes. If they bought that hospital property, why don't they build the dorms there instead of on
She addressed that a little bit earlier, because I kind of asked that question about 45 minutes ago.
Oh, I might have missed it.
Yeah, I think the reason she said, I mean, it would make sense to build it on, I mean, in terms of environmentally, it would make terms makes sense to build it where the hospital was, because that's already been built on and it's not the greatest soil. What Laura said is that the college is trying to keep all the buildings clustered so that where the garden is, it's just right across the canyon, and it bridges across the canyon and takes you right to, there's actually on that side of the canyon, there's some dorms that are like down in the bottom of the canyon, and then you go across a bridge and then you're right on the main part of the campus. So they try, and there's another set of dorms that are just east and a little bit south of where the garden is as well, that they built about 10 years ago. So it's kind of in keeping with that. I mean, it's like that master plan that thinks only in terms of building clusters and not thinking in terms of the efficacy of the importance of this garden.
They're not that close to the other dorms from what I remember, but, I mean, compared to the hospital, I mean, it's not that different.
No, it's not. You're talking about, and the other thing is the hospital was right on the sidewalk, so you could walk down 28th, which is a nice, safe street. It might integrate Reed a little better into the neighborhood, and you're very close to the campus that way, too. Yeah, I mean, I would agree that one of the things that the people were talking about, the garden on Saturday, is they've got this huge area. And first of all, the garden is so big, you're not going to build a dorm that's 2 acres in size. So already, I mean, they don't need the entire garden space, the existing garden space, to build the dorm. And why can't they move the dorm someplace else? But they're talking about moving the garden. One idea is to move it a little bit to the west. But where the soil is still good, but you're right up against some buildings that are built right on 28th, and it's not going to be nearly as beautiful and as private and as natural as the current place.
Yeah, well, they also built that huge field just to the east.
Right.
And that's kind of like, and it's very underutilized.
Yeah, the big soccer field.
Yes.
It's funny, Reed College, I cracked up when I watched them putting that field in, because that was a really beautiful open space. I mean, it was basically a wildflower field, and it wasn't, I mean, what it was not a natural field. I mean, the college said that there was native lupin growing in there, but it wasn't like an open meadow that was natural. It probably, maybe it had been agricultural land at some point, I'm assuming, but it was just basically a flat field that had a lot of interesting wild stuff growing, and then they went and they put the dorm in and they built that soccer field. And I'm thinking Reed College, which is famous for having no sports.
Exactly.
And why do they build a and you look, and I go by there all the time, and I would say that I've seen people playing on that field, you know, maybe it's like 1/20th of the time that is available. That is basically really underutilized. And you know, you wonder, like, why don't they just put a dorm where the soccer field is?
Yeah, I thought that years ago when they put the soccer field in. But at the same time, we have to give Reed credit for being generous and offering that space.
And the people are doing, I mean, I was interviewing a lot of people on this, and the people are being very generous right now, even though I think that there is some feeling, like thinking ahead, well, if Reed remains obstinate, what is our next plan, and when does this go from negotiation to resistance, basically. But they're all maintaining a real hopeful attitude that Reed will basically see the light and respect what they're doing, and that by putting a certain kind of community pressure on Reed, but in a gentle way as opposed to a confrontational way, mm-hmm. and they're really trying to negotiate, and they're doing it in good faith. In fact, Merrilee was telling me on Saturday, Merrilee Day, who's one of the garden managers, and she's really kind of a spearheading this whole community effort to save the garden. And she was saying that they wouldn't have known about this hearing on Tuesday except that one of the people who works in the garden also works on campus doing maintenance, and found he came upon one of these leaflets posted way up by the administration building and brought it down to the garden, and they went, oh, there's a hearing. I think we should be there.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the gardeners, and Merrilee, who's on this advisory committee for the college about what's going to happen with this space, she wasn't even informed of this hearing. So the college is not working in good faith with the people who are trying to save the garden.
Oh, it's too bad.
Yeah, it is, and it's very different. I mean, you think about Reed having allowed the space to be gardened for 30 years. I mean, it says an awful lot about their commitment to the community 30 years ago when they offered this space, and what, you know, like what's kind of happened since and why have things changed so much.
Well, great.
Okay,
go.
Sure, thanks for calling. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. And we're talking this morning about community gardens. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this garden in Los Angeles, which I actually heard about for the first time on Saturday when I went up to talk with people at the garden and to do some recording. There was this man, Emmanuel, who's a very interesting guy. He gardens there, and he's recently moved to Portland from Berkeley. In Berkeley, he was involved with People's Park for 7 years. And for those of you who don't remember what People's Park was, back in 1969, before that actually, in the late 60s, the University of California at Berkeley basically tore down this block of student housing that was over just on the South Campus off of Telegraph Avenue, because according to Emmanuel, it was a hotbed of student protest and sort of the center of the free speech movement and the anti-war movement at UC Berkeley. So they tore down the housing, and they just basically... it was a parking lot for a long time. And so some community leaders and student activists and other people decided it would be a really great place to build a park. And so they broke up the concrete, and they trucked in soil, and they worked the soil, and they planted all kinds of stuff and put in sod. And part of the area was a dedicated community garden. And then the college tried to seize back the land, and there was a big pitch battle back in the spring of 1969. I do believe that's when it was, and there was major, like, war on the streets of Berkeley. In fact, a man was shot with birdshot and was blinded by the Berkeley police, and tear gas hung throughout the air on campus and off campus, and the park was seized back by the city and the college, the university. And when I was in Berkeley the next year, there was a place called People's Park Annex that was west and basically west of the campus, about a half a mile. And that was kind of like the holdout where people like went to People's Park Annex and kind of regrouped. It was just a very small park. Well, People's Park was kind of reclaimed by the community, and it's still in existence, and there's a very large community garden there, and the university periodically tries to take back the park, and the community organizes in Berkeley style and holds on to it. So it's been kind of a tension for, 40 years now over People's Park, but it's still going strong. So Emmanuel is now working a plot at the Reed Community Garden, and he has this whole memory and history of the struggle around People's Park, which is an interesting perspective to add to this issue. But he was saying how amazing it was to him that, you know, you expect from UC Berkeley, with all its ties to the war industry and it's a huge, you know, one of the huge edifices of America, and certainly tied to the industrial military complex in many, many intense ways. And Reed is a small private college and has a very long progressive history, and it has had historically very good connections with the community and seen itself as an important player in the community there. That he's amazed that Reed would sort of be following suit in the UC Berkeley style, and, you know, trying to deny the community something that the community has been working very hard to build for so many years. So that's kind of another interesting way to look at it. And then the other struggle, so he was talking actually about this big, actually it started an urban farm in L.A. It's a 14-acre farm in South Central L.A. that kind of came out of the riots in 1992. It was an area that was leveled during the riots, burnt out, and the kind of all these battles that were going on over what was going to happen post-riot in Los Angeles. The I guess the food bank or a food bank group got a hold of the land and has been turned it into a community garden. It's a vast community garden. 14 acres makes about 7 times the size of the Reed Garden. And I guess very extensive farming has been going on there for the last 14 years. And then it was sold to a developer within a year ago or so. And they're going to put up housing because property values have skyrocketed again in Los Angeles. And so that's sort of the big problem, is that people who have a kind of a narrow urban focus, particularly developers and city officials and planners who see like developers, only see the value of land for development and don't see the value of land as being kept in its natural state or being gardened. And so this has been this big struggle in Los Angeles, and all kinds of famous people have come out in support of the garden. And there was a famous actress who was up in a tree yesterday protesting. And when the sheriffs came in to evict everybody from the garden yesterday morning, she'd been, Daryl Hannah, that's who it was. Anyway, she'd been sleeping in a tent on the, camping out on the garden, and she was warned, and she wound up running up a tree and was staying up there. And she got taken down from the tree last night. But it's certainly, this garden in L.A. has certainly focused a lot of attention on the importance of urban agriculture and the importance of being able to grow our own food in cities. And having it being the demise of this garden, I think, you know, is like a real big blow for the urban garden movement. And it shows the importance of protecting things here. We don't want that happening here in Portland, and we have our kind of our own miniature version of that happening with the Reed Community Garden. So if you want to give a call and talk about gardening or food sustainability in the city or protecting the Reed Garden in particular, if you have been gardening at the Reed Plot or any of the other community gardens around the city, you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 20 minutes before 9 o'clock here on Locus Focus. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello. I'd just like to say that a lot of these problems would be non-problems if local governments had the courage and the intelligence to legislate fixed and finite limits to the value and the selling price of real property. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for calling. It's another discussion. Actually, I've had that with people over the last few years a lot, the idea of property as and land as being something that you speculate on and use it as a way of investment, as opposed to something that has of use for people to live on and people to grow things on and for nature to thrive on. And I think that that's actually a really good point. Again, if you want to join the conversation, give a call at 503-231-8187. I want to let you know that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 o'clock is Movie Talk with Ed, Don, and DK on the latest movies. At 9:30, we'll hear a recent talk in Portland by Father Boy Roy Bourgeois of the School of the Americas Watch. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Gella addresses the issue of network neutrality with Janine Kennedy, Senior Policy Analyst with Consumers Union, and Jeff Chester, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy. At 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, journalist Dar Jamil discusses the killing of 2 pregnant Iraqi women and how the U.S. military may have tried to cover it up. And Greg Palast talks about the disenfranchisement of black voters. And just as an aside on that, I've been staying up too late the last couple nights reading this article that's in Rolling Stone, relatively recently, by Robert Kennedy Jr. about how the 2004 election was stolen, and all the worse than counting impropriety that went on in Ohio. And a very interesting article, and I thought the fact that Robert Kennedy Jr. is taking on this issue, and he is somebody who is relatively mainstream, though quite progressive, and quite forceful, it may be reopening the discussion again about what happened to the elections in 2004. So that's what's coming up here in the next 15 minutes here on KBOO, but we've got about another 15 minutes left to talk about that important subject, to me, one of the most important subjects of all, which is gardening, particularly gardening in the city and being able to grow our own food, and why that keeps us connected to life, and it's also why it's a very extremely revolutionary act, I think. And interestingly, it's on this month's cover of Mother Jones, is Michael Pollan, an excerpt from Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. It's called No Barcode, and it's a section that he wrote about the sustainable farm in Virginia, which everything feeds everything else, and it's like all about like eating locally and why that's important. But Time Magazine as well is devoted a whole section in their current issue about food, and there's a one-page article about the 100-mile rule, where you shouldn't eat anything that is grown or produced or whatever raised more than 100 miles from where you live. And the fact that Time Magazine is starting to talk about the whole local sustainable food movement is very encouraging to me. So we'll be talking a lot more about that. It's what we've been talking about on this show for the last 3 weeks, and we'll continue to talk about it. And actually, coming up in a couple of weeks, we're going to have another Whole Communities Radio Project special, and we talking about the importance of protecting our urban creeks and all those creeks in Portland that run underground in pipes, and what we can do to kind of reconnect ourselves to the water of our city. And we're going to be having some of our standbys here. We're going to have Bob Salinger from the Portland Audubon Society, and Mike Houck with Urban Green Spaces, who's been very involved with protecting natural space in the city for a long time. And I'm hoping maybe to get Steve Johnson on as well from Johnson Creek Watershed Council. And it kind of will be a reunion of a show we did just about a year ago, one of the early Whole Community shows about urban nature. So it's kind of a topic we keep coming back to because it's a really important part of having a place we can live in. But we've got another little while here to talk about urban gardens and the Reed Garden in particular. So you can give a call at 503-231-8187. It's about 15 minutes before 9 o'clock. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Barbara.
Hi.
I'd heard that the L.A. Lot there where the garden is being displaced is being is for a warehouse and not housing, so I'm not sure.
I don't know, actually. I mean, I've read one article about it, and I heard this guy Emmanuel talking about it on Saturday. So I don't know. It could be. I mean, it's just. It's,
that's what I've heard in
it's commercial. It's commercial building, though. It's certainly just like they thought they make more money building on this lot than letting it be a farm.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. It's commercial, so I'm wondering if it's. Well, warehouse is what I heard. So I'm wondering if it's going to be a warehouse to store food in. Food grown from, you know, like. Who knows where, and then they put it in a box, you know, and then take it to the warehouse and store it, right? So kind of an irony I'm aiming at here. And,
yeah.
And I also wanted to talk about other kinds of warehouses being proposed for Portland in the form of a Walmart warehouse, which is all they are, tilt-up warehouse with a front on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the one in Hayden Island, you know, this latest one they're proposing on the Red Lion hotel site. You know about that one?
No, I haven't heard about that one.
You know, the Red Lion on Hayden Island,
right?
So I like that hotel. That's, you know, it's very architecturally attractive, I think. And as far as land use goes, its value on the river is higher use, more valuable use as a hotel than as a warehouse.
So is Red Lion thinking of pulling out of that hotel, or what's...
Well, you know, it's gotten to the point where it's out-competed by other hotels in the area, so now it's losing its viability economically, and so it's closed. And my point is, all those people that visited the Red Lion, you know, enjoyed the water view and enjoyed Portland, now they're not going to be able to do that because Walmart wants to use the land for something other than its highest value, just like the place in L.A. And there's another Walmart, you know, the one out in Cedar Hills?
Cedar Mill.
Mill.
Yeah, but we've talked a lot about that on the show.
Right, well, you know how much traffic there is going up Burnside? You know, Burnside. If for that transit corridor is ever going to work to reduce the volumes of individuals driving there, then the corridor has to have less of that kind of structure in order to, because transit, you know, you don't take transit to a big box warehouse. So if you're going to reduce the traffic, you can't build a Walmart on that site. It has to be something more than that. So it's another example of some corporate crook disregarding, you know, the best land use, ending up, you know, doing the same things happening down there in L.A. Just wanton destruction, in my opinion.
Okay.
But the Walmart out in Cedar Mills, it's not the best use of that land out there.
Actually, the best use of that land, I think, would be to leave it be. It's my sense, though. It's sort of been destroyed by this.
You know, in order to build a transit corridor, I mean, you could leave a good part of it be, but in order to get people out of their cars, which is our big environmental degradation, and cost of living, everyone driving, is then if you have some development, you can put in your desirable development in there and some preservation. You do want to preserve, but it's that mix of uses, you know, that the urbanists are saying is what works best, and you have to have that open space, and that you include the farming in with the built environment. And so rather than just leaving it open, which you may be right, if there's some development is desirable to put in there, it would certainly be better than a Walmart.
Well, actually, the problem with that corner is the people who own that land, the Peter Courts, have already put in this shopping mall across the street from where the proposed Walmart would go.
Yeah.
And they've already gone a really long way in destroying the potential land use possibilities for that area as a walkable, transit-oriented community. I mean, it's a really wretched mall, and it's just got a huge amount of parking, and it has the kinds of stores that draw people in cars, even though a smaller scale than a Walmart would. But I think that the problems are with the way that the Peter Courts have developed their property. It's been kind of a high-density, single-family, overly large houses on this big, steep hill that's half a mile uphill from where the Walmart would be. And they didn't put... It's north, right north on the 113th Street extension. Yeah. And they didn't build any retail within walking distance of where all those houses went. And so that's the first problem. So the retail is a half a mile down, and it's the style of retail where you're going to drive. And
right.
So there's been a lot of problems already in developing. And I think that, unfortunately, the people in Cedar Mill didn't start organizing soon enough. And now
they're facing a Walmart.
Right, and it's a big hard lesson. But they should have been working on really, developing a walkable neighborhood of mixed business and retail and commercial and residential and open space along Cornell Road, where the historic development has been, and let the rest of those woods and everything else that were, sort of shaped that neighborhood and made it this little kind of rural village.
I know.
And it's been destroyed by the development that Peter Court's been encouraging.
Same thing there that's now happening in everywhere, not just down in L.A., along this one place.
Right. Yeah, so I think that...
So just put up whatever. Yeah. Who cares?
But anyway, I think the lessons are you got to start thinking about planning way early when you still have the resources and you can still protect the space.
Yeah,
and that's
have to think about planning as in order to restore what we've ruined.
Right, and I think that's what's going on in Damascus. People are trying to plan from the beginning
Indeed.
As opposed to letting it all happen piecemeal. Anyway, I've got to get going, so thanks for calling.
You bet.
And the number to call is 503-231-8187, and we've got about another 5 minutes so we can talk about these things. And I just want to reiterate the importance of being connected to our food. And for the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about a whole lot of parts of what would be the sustainable food chain. Food chain where the food comes from as close to where you live as possible. It spends very little time and costs and fuel being shipped or stored. We eat things in season. We eat things that are fresh. We eat things that are local. We eat things that are hopefully grown with little or no pesticides. And that's a vision of a sustainable food chain. And the best place to become connected to that food chain is when you grow your own food. And I will say that I really changed my sense of the taste of corn when I started growing corn a number of years ago. And I'm very sorry that I don't have enough room in my garden where I've been living for the last 13 years to grow corn. And actually, I've been looking around for a community garden plot for a while to put some of the vegetables that I can't grow in my backyard. And that's one of the beauties about community gardens is that, I have a very small backyard garden plot. But if I had a community garden plot, I could grow things that take up more space, like zucchini and corn and potatoes. But there's nothing like going out in your backyard or going out to your community garden plot, picking a couple ears of corn, running them home, throwing them in boiling water, and eating them 7 minutes later. And even if you go out to Subbies Island and pick corn, which is a pretty cool thing to do, it's not, the time it takes you to get home, however long it takes you, the corn has lost this amazing flavor that it has like as soon as it's being picked. And that sort of connection to what food can taste like, and it's not just the fact that it tastes so good, it's also that good for you. I think that the really fine taste of food is a reflection of just the nutrients that are there when it's really fresh and how good it is for our bodies. And community gardens are our community way of reinforcing that connection to the land, and it's a real incredible teaching tool. And I should have been working in community gardens 20 years ago. I would have learned an awful lot more about gardening a lot faster because, as Laura, who was here earlier, you know, described, that you have these old-timers that really know things. And actually, it's one of the things I've been doing, hanging out at the Reed Community Garden and getting gardening tips from all the gardeners there, because there's a whole amazing amount of knowledge that gets shared. And so I think that this is like a value that I'm kind of really going on a big role about promoting this. And the fact that this hearing is happening today downtown to look at the future of the Reed Garden in the context of Reed's master plan is a really important moment for people in this community to speak out about the need for gardens. So even if you aren't a gardener and you don't have much of a sense of you know, what it's like to grow food, I think if you were to go and spend just a little time visiting one of the community gardens around town, it'll connect you with what, you know, with this aspect of nature, the part of nature that feeds ourselves, which is a really powerful connection to have. So I'm kind of going to go out on that. And in 2 weeks, again, we'll be doing more about urban nature and the importance of protecting nature. And in 2 weeks, we'll be focusing specifically on creeks in our city. And we have time, if there is another caller, we've got time to take one more caller before we get out of here. But I think since there aren't any more callers, we're just going to go out with some music. And I'll be back next week. And stay tuned, coming up in just a few moments, it's Ed, Don, and DK in the latest movies. We're going to go out with Natalie Merchant and Motherland.
Where in hell can you go? Far from the things that you know, far from the sprawl of concrete that keeps crawling its way, about 1,000 miles a day. Take one last look behind, commit this to memory and mind. Don't miss this wasteland, this terrible place, when you leave. Keep your heart off your sleeve. Motherland, cradle me. Close my eyes, lullaby me to sleep. Keep me safe, lie with me, stay. Beside me, don't go. Don't you go. Oh, my five and dime queen, tell me, what have you seen? Lost in the avarice, the bottomless, the cavernous greed. Is that what you see? Oh, motherland, cradle me. Close my eyes, lullaby me to sleep. Keep me safe, lie with me, stay beside me, don't go. It's your happiness. Most of all, and for that I'd do anything at all. Oh, mercy me, give you all the best of this, or the most of all. If there's anything I can do at all, come on, shotgun bride, what makes me envy your life? Faceless, nameless. tree. What's that like to be? It's almost 9 a.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on the KBOO Wednesday Radio Zine at 9, coming right up, it's Movie Talk with Ed, Don, and DK on the latest movies. At 9:30, we'll hear a recent talk in Portland by Father Roy Burgois of the School of the Americas Watch. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller addresses the issue of network neutrality with Janine Kenny, Senior Policy Analyst with Consumers Union, and Jeff Chester, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, journalist Dara Jamil discusses the killing of two pregnant Iraqi women and how the U.S. military may have tried to cover it up. And Greg Palast talks about the disenfranchisement of black voters, disenfranchisement. Sorry, guys. Well, you know, it's early in the morning.